Slick said, suddenly aware of his own smell, of the grease worked into his jeans and brown jacket. And Gentry didn't really look all that much more reassuring.
I shouldn't think so, she said, and her white teeth flashed again in the stale undersea light. But then I don't think I fancy either of you.
Slick wanted Gentry to say something, but Gentry didn't.
You know him? Bobby?
Slick ventured.
He's really a very clever man. Extraordinarily clever. Although I don't think I fancy him, really.
She wore something loose and black that hung to her knees. Her feet were bare.
Nonetheless, I want his body.
She laughed. Everything changed.
Juice?
Bobby the Count asked, holding out a tall glass of something yellow. The water in the turquoise pool reflected shifting blobs of sunlight on the palm fronds above his head. He was naked, aside from a pair of very dark glasses. What's the matter with your friend?
Nothing, Slick heard Gentry say. He did time on induced Korsakoff's. Transition like that scares the shit out of him.
Slick lay very still on the white iron lounge chair with the blue cushions, feeling the sun bake through his greasy jeans.
You're the one he mentioned, right?
Bobby asked.
Name's Gentle, own a factory.
Gentry.
You're a cowboy.
Bobby smiled.
Console jockey, cyberspace man.
No.
Bobby rubbed his chin.
You know I have to shave in here? Cut myself, there's a scar.
He drank half the glass of juice and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
You're not a jockey. How else you get in here?
Gentry unzipped his beaded jacket, exposing his bone-white, hairless chest.
Do something about the sun,
he said. Twilight. Like that. Not even a click. Slick heard himself groan. Insects began to creak in the palms beyond the whitewashed wall. Sweat cooled on his ribs.
Sorry, man, Bobby said to Slick. That Korsakov's, that must be some sad shit, but this place is beautiful. Vallarta. Belonged to Tali Isham.
He turned his attention to Gentry again. If you're not a cowboy fellow, what are you?
I'm like you, Gentry said.
I'm a cowboy.
A lizard scooted diagonally up the wall behind Bobby's head.
No, you aren't here to steal anything, Newmark.
How do you know?
You're here to learn something.
Same thing.
No. You were a cowboy once, but now you're something else. You're looking for something, but there's nobody to steal it from. I'm looking for it, too.
And Gentry began to explain about the shape. As the palm shadows gathered and thickened into Mexican night, and Bobby the Count sat and listened. When Gentry was done, Bobby sat there for a long time without saying anything. Then he said,
Yeah, you're right. How I think of it, I'm trying to find out what brought the change.
Before that, Gentry said, it didn't have a shape.
Hey, Slick said, before we were here, we were somewhere else. Where was that?
Straylight, Bobby said.
Up the well, in orbit.
Who's that girl?
Girl?
Dark hair, skinny.
Oh,
Bobby said in the dark.
That was 3 Jane. You saw her? Weird girl.
Slick said.
Dead girl, Bobby said. You saw her construct. Blew her family fortune to build this thing.
You, hang out with her in here?
She hates my guts. See, I stole it. Stole her soul catcher. She had her construct in place in here when I took off for Mexico. So she's always been around. Thing was, she died. Outside, I mean. Meantime, all her shit outside, all her scams and schemes that's being run by lawyers, programs, more flunkies. He grinned. It really pisses her off. The people who are trying to get into your place to get the Aleph back, they work for somebody else. Who works for some people she hired out on the coast. But yeah, I've done the odd deal with her, traded things. She's crazy, but she plays a tight game. Not even a click. At first he thought he was back in the gray house, where he'd seen Bobby the first time, but this room was smaller, and the carpets and furniture were different. He couldn't say how. Rich, but not as glittery. Quiet. A lamp with a green glass shade glowed on a long wooden table. Tall windows with frames painted white, dividing the white beyond that into rectangles, each pane, and that must be snow. He stood with his cheek touching soft drapes, looking out into a walled space of snow.
London, Bobby said. She had to trade me this to get the serious voodoo shit. Thought they wouldn't have anything to do with her. Fuck of a lot of good it did her. They've been fading, sort of blurring. You can still raise them sometimes, but their personalities run together.
That fits, Gentry said. They came out of the first cause, when it changed.
You already figured that. But you don't know what happened yet, do you?
No. I just know where. Straylight. She's told me all that part. I think all she knows. Doesn't really care about it. Her mother put together a couple of AIs very early on, real heavy stuff. Then her mother died and the AIs sort of stewed in the corporate cores up there. One of them started doing deals on its own. It wanted to get together with the other one.
It did. There's your first cause. Everything changed.
Simple as that. How do you know?
Because, Gentry said, I've been at it from another angle. You've been playing cause and effect, but I've been looking for outlines, shapes and time. You've been looking all over the Matrix, but I've been looking at the Matrix. The whole thing. I know things you don't.
Bobby didn't answer. Slick turned from the window and saw the girl, the same one, standing across the room, just standing there.
It wasn't just the Tessier Ashpool AIs, Gentry said. People came up the well to crack the TA course. They brought a Chinese military icebreaker.
Case, Bobby said. Guy named Case. I know that part. Some kind of synergistic effect.
Slick watched the girl.
And the sum was greater than the parts?
Gentry really seemed to be enjoying this.
Cybernetic godhead! Light on the waters?
Yeah, Bobby said. That's about it.
It's a little more complicated than that,
Gentry said and laughed. And the girl was gone. No click. Slick shivered. Chapter 32 Winter Journey 2 Night fell during the underground's peak evening traffic. Though even then it was nothing like Tokyo. No Shiroshi-san struggling to wedge last few passengers in as the doors were closing. Kumiko watched the salmon haze of sunset from a windy platform on the central line. Colin lounging against a broken vending machine with a row of cracked, dusty windows.
Time now, he said. And keep your head demurely down through Bond Street and Oxford Circus.
But I must pay when I leave the system?
Not everyone does, actually, he said, tossing his forelock.
She set off for the stairs, no longer requiring his directions to find her way to the opposite platform. Her feet were very cold again, and she thought of the fleece-lined German boots in the closet in her room at Swain's. She decided on the combination of the rubber-toe socks and the high French heels as a ploy to lull Dick, to make him doubt she'd run, but with each bite of cold through the thin soles, she regretted the idea. In the tunnel to the other platform, she relaxed her grip on the unit and Colin flickered out. The walls were worn white ceramic with a decorative band of green. She took her hand from her pocket and trailed her fingers along the green tiles as she went, thinking of Sally and the Finn, and the different smell of a sprawl winter. Until the first Dracula stepped smartly in front of her, and she was instantly and very closely surrounded by four black raincoats, four bone-thin, bone-white faces.
Yeah,
the first one said.
Ain't it pretty?
They were eye to eye, Kumiko and the Dracula. His breath smelled of tobacco. The evening crowd continued on its way around them, bundled for the most part in dark wool.
Oh, one said beside her. Look, what's this?
He held up the Mas Neotech unit, his hand gloved in cracked black leather.
Flashlight, ain't it? Let's have a snag, Jep.
Kumiko's hand went to her pocket, shot straight through the razor slash, and closed on air. The boy giggled.
Snags in a bag, another said. Elbow ridge?
A hand darted out, and the leather strap of her purse parted neatly. The first Dracula caught the purse, whipped the dangling strap around it with a practiced flick, and tucked it into the front of his raincoat.
Ta.
Yeah, she's got him in her pants.
Laughter as she fumbled beneath layered sweaters. The tape she'd used hurt her stomach as she tore the gun free with both hands and flipped it up against the cheek of the boy who held the unit. Nothing happened. Then the other three were racing frantically for the stairs at the far end of the tunnel, their high-laced black boots slipping in melted snow, their long coats flapping like wings. A woman screamed. And still they were frozen there. Kumiko and the Dracula. The muzzle of the pistol pressed against his left cheekbone. Kumiko's arms began to tremble. She was looking into the Dracula's eyes. Brown eyes gone wide with an ancient, simple terror. The Dracula was seeing her mother's mask. Something struck the concrete at her feet. Colin's unit.
Run,
she said. The Dracula convulsed, opened his mouth, made a strangled, sobbing sound, and twisted away from the gun. Kumiko looked down and saw the Mas Neotech unit in a puddle of gray slush. Beside it lay the clean silver rectangle of a single-edged industrial razor blade. When she picked up the unit, she saw that its case was cracked. She shook moisture from the crack and squeezed it hard in her hand. The tunnel was deserted now. Colin wasn't there. Soyeon's Volta air pistol was huge and heavy in her other hand. She stepped to a rectangular receptacle, fastened to the tile wall, and tucked the gun down between a grease-flecked foam food container and a neatly folded sheaf of newsfax. Turned away, then turned back for the fax. Up the stairs. Someone pointed at her on the platform. But the train roared in with its antique clatter, and then the doors slid shut behind her. She did as Colin had instructed. White City and Shepherd's Bush, Holland Park, raising the fax as the train slowed for Notting Hill. The king, who was very old, was dying, and keeping it there through Bond Street. The station at Oxford Circus was very busy, and she was grateful for the sheltering crowd. Colin had said that it was possible to leave the station without paying. After some consideration, she decided that this was true, though it required speed and timing. Really, there was no other way. Her purse, with the Mitsu bank chip and her few English coins, had gone with the Jack Draculas. She spent 10 minutes watching passengers surrender their yellow plastic tickets to the automated turnstiles, took a deep breath, and ran. Up, over, behind her a shout and a loud laugh. And then she was running again. When she reached the doors at the top of the stairs, she saw Brixton Road waiting like a tatty Shinjuku, jammed with steaming food stalls. Chapter 33 Star. She was waiting in a car, and she didn't like it. She didn't like waiting anyway, but the whiz she'd done made it really hard. She had to keep reminding herself not to grit her teeth, because whatever Gerald had done to them, they were still sore. She was sore all over, now that she thought about it. Probably the whiz hadn't been such a great idea. The car belonged to the woman, the one Gerald called Molly. Some kind of regular gray Japanese car, like a suit would have. Nice enough, but nothing you'd notice. It had that new smell inside, and it was fast when they got out of Baltimore. It had a computer, but the woman drove it herself, all the way back to the sprawl, and now it was parked on the roof of a 20-level lot that must be close to the hotel where Pryor had taken her, because she could see that crazy building, the one with the waterfall, fixed up like a mountain. There weren't many other cars up here, and the ones that were humped over with snow, like they hadn't moved in a long time. Except for the two guys in the booth where you drove in, there didn't seem to be anybody around at all. Here she was, in the middle of all those people, the biggest city in the world, and she was alone in the back seat of a car, told to wait. The woman hadn't said much when they'd come from Baltimore. Just asked a question now and then. But the whiz had made it hard for Mona not to talk. She'd talked about Cleveland and Florida and Eddie and Pryor. Then they'd driven up here and parked. So this Molly'd been gone at least an hour now, maybe longer. She'd taken a suitcase with her. The only thing Mona'd been able to get out of her was that she'd known Gerald a long time, and Pryor hadn't known that. It was getting cold in the car again, so Mona climbed into the front seat and turned on the heater. She couldn't just leave it on low, because it might run the battery down, and Molly'd said if that happened, they were really in the shit. 'Cause when I come back, we leave in a hurry. Then she'd shown Mona where there was a sleeping bag under the driver's seat. She set the heater on high and held her hands in front of the vent. Then she fiddled with the little vid studs beside the dash monitor and got a news show. The King of England was sick. He was really old. There was a new disease in Singapore. It hadn't killed anybody yet, but nobody knew how you got it or how to cure it. Some people thought there was some kind of big fight going on in Japan. Two different bunches of Yakuza guys trying to kill each other, but nobody really knew. Yakuza. That was something Eddie liked to bullshit about. Then these doors popped open and Angie came through on the arm of this amazing black guy, and the vid voice was saying this was live. She'd just arrived in the sprawl after a brief vacation at her house in Malibu, following treatment at a private drug clinic. Angie looked just great in this big fur. But then the segment was over. Mona remembered what Gerald had done. She touched her face. She shut off the vid, then the heater, and got into the back seat again. Used the corner of the sleeping bag to clean her condensed breath off the window. She looked up at the mountainside building all lit up, past the sagging chain link at the edge of the car lot's roof. Like a whole country up there. Maybe Colorado or something. Like the stem where Angie went to Aspen and met this boy. Only Robin turned up like he almost always did. But what she didn't understand was this clinic stuff. How that barman had said Angie had gone there because she was wired on something. And now she'd just heard the news guy say it too. So she guessed it had to be true. But why would anybody like Angie, with a life like that, and Robin Lanier for a boyfriend, want to do drugs? Mona shook her head, looking out at that building, glad she wasn't hooked on anything. She must have drifted off for a minute, thinking about Lynette, because when she looked again, there was a copter, a big one, glittery black, poised above the mountain building. It looked good, real big town. She'd known some rough women in Cleveland, girls nobody messed with. But this Molly was something else. Remembering Pryor coming through that door, remembering him screaming. She wondered what it was he'd finally admitted, because she'd heard him talking, and Molly hadn't hurt him anymore. They'd left him strapped in that chair, and Mona had asked Molly if she thought he'd get loose. Either that, Molly had said, or somebody finds him, or he dehydrates. The copter settled, vanished. Big one. The kind with the whirly thing at both ends. So here she was, waiting, no fucking idea what else to do. Something Lynette had taught her. Sometimes you had to list your assets. Assets were what you had going for you, and just forget the other stuff. Okay. She was out of Florida. She was in Manhattan. She looked like Angie. That one stopped her. Was that an asset? Okay. Putting it another way, she just had a fortune in free cosmetic surgery, and she had totally perfect teeth. Anyway, look at it that way, and it wasn't so bad. Think about the flies in the squat. Yeah. If she spent the money she had left on a haircut and some makeup, she could come up with something that didn't look all that much like Angie, which was probably a good idea. Because what if somebody was looking for her? There went the copter again, lifting off. Hey. Maybe two blocks away and 50 stories higher, the thing's nose swung toward her. Dipped. It's the Wiz. Sort of wobbled there, then it was coming down. Wiz, it's not real. Straight down toward her. It just got bigger. Toward her. But it's the Wiz, right? Then it was gone. Behind another building, and it was just the Wiz. It swung around a corner, still five stories above the roof of the car lot, and was still coming down, and it wasn't the Wiz. It was on her. A tight white beam stabbing out to find the gray car. And Mona popped the door lock and rolled out into the snow, still in the car's shadow. All around her, the thunder of the thing's blades, its engines. Pryor, or whoever he worked for, and they were after her. Then the spotlight went out. Blades changed pitch,
and it came down fast, too fast. Bounced on its landing gear, slammed down again, engines dying, coughing blue flame. Mona was on her hands and knees by the car's rear bumper, slipped when she tried to get to her feet. There was a sound like a gunshot. A square section of the copter's skin blew out and skidded across the lot's salt-stained concrete. A bright orange 5-meter emergency exit slide popped out, inflating like a kid's beach toy. Mona got up more carefully, holding on to the gray car's fender. A dark, bundled figure swung its legs out over the slide and went down, sitting up, just like a kid at a playground. Another figure followed, this one padded in a huge hooded jacket the same color as the slide. Mona shivered as the one in orange led the other toward her across the roof, away from the black copter. It was. "Want you both in back," Molly said, opening the door on the driver's side.
"It's you," Mona managed, to the most famous face in the world.
"Yes," Angie said, her eyes on Mona's face.
"It seems to be."
"Come on," Molly said, her hand on the star's shoulder.
"Get in.
Your Martian spade'll be waking up already." She glanced back at the helicopter. It looked like a big toy sitting there, no lights, like a giant kid had put it down and forgotten it.
"He'd better be,"
Angie said, climbing into the back of the car.
"You too, hon,"
Molly said, pushing Mona toward the open door.
"But, I mean..."
"Move!"
Mona climbed in, smelling Angie's perfume, wrist brushing the supernatural softness of that big fur.
"I saw you,"
she heard herself say.
"On the vid."
Angie didn't say anything.
Molly slid into the driver's seat, yanked the door shut, and started the engine. The orange hood was snugged up tight, her face a white mask with blank silver eyes. Then they were rolling toward the sheltered ramp, swinging into the first curve, down 5 levels like that, in a tight spiral, and Molly swung them off into aisles of larger vehicles under dim green diagonals of light strip.
"Parafoils," Molly said. "You ever see any parafoil gear up the Envoy?"
"No,"
Angie said. "If Net Security has any, they could be upstairs already."
She swung the car in behind a big, long, boxy hover, a white one with a name painted across the rear doors in square blue letters.
"What's it say?"
Mona asked, then felt herself blush. "Cathode Cafe," Angie said. Mona thought she'd heard that name before. Molly was out there opening those big doors, pulling down these yellow plastic ramp things. Then she was back in the car, reversed, put it in drive, and then rolled right up into the hover. She stripped back the orange hood and shook her head to free her hair.
"Mona, you think you can get out there and shove those ramps back in? They aren't heavy."
It didn't sound like a question. They weren't heavy. She pulled herself up behind the car and helped Molly pull the door shut. She could feel Angie there in the dark. It was really Angie.
"Up front, strap in, hold on."
Angie. She was sitting right beside Angie.
There was a whoosh as Molly filled the hover's bags. Then they were skimming down the spiral ramp.
"Your friend," Molly said.
"He's awake by now, but he can't really move yet. Another 15 minutes. She swung off the ramp again, and this time Mona had lost track of the levels. This one was packed with fancy cars, little ones. The hover roared along a central aisle, swung left.
"You'll be lucky if he isn't waiting for us outside," Angie said.
Molly brought them to a halt, 10 meters from a big metal door painted with diagonal stripes, yellow and black.
No,
Molly said, taking a little blue box from the dash compartment. He's lucky if he's not waiting outside. The door blew out of its frame with an orange flash and a sound that slammed into Mona's diaphragm like a solid blow. It crashed into the wet street in a cloud of smoke, and then they were over it, turning, the hover accelerating.
This is awfully crude, isn't it?
Angie said, and actually laughed.
I know, Molly said, intent on her driving.
Sometimes that's just the way to go.
Mona, tell her about Pryor.
Pryor and your boyfriend. What you told me.
Mona hadn't ever felt so shy in her life.
Please, Angie said, tell me.
Mona.
Just like that. Her name. Angie Mitchell had actually said her name. To her. Right there.
It made her want to faint. Chapter 34. Margate Road.
You seem lost,
the noodle seller said in Japanese. Kumiko guessed that he was Korean. Her father had associates who were Korean. They were in the construction business, her mother had said. They tended, like this one, to be large men, very nearly as large as Petal, with broad, serious faces.
You look very cold.
I am looking for someone, she said. He lives in Margate Road.
Where's that?
I don't know.
Come inside, the noodle man said, gesturing Kumiko around the end of his counter. His stall was made of pink corrugated plastic. She stepped between the noodle stall and another that advertised something called roti. This word worked in deliriously colored spray bomb capitals trimmed with looping luminous blobs. That stall smelled of spices and stewing meat. Her feet were very cold. She ducked beneath a clouded sheet of plastic. The noodle stall was crowded. Squat blue tanks of butane. The three cooking grids with their tall pots. Plastic sacks of noodles. Stacks of foam bowls. And the shifting bulk of the big Korean as he tended his pots.
Sit,
he said. She sat on a yellow plastic canister of MSG, her head below the level of the counter.
You're Japanese.
Yes, she said.
Tokyo?
She hesitated.
You're close, he said. Why do you wear rubber tabby socks in winter? Is this the fashion?
I lost my boots.
He passed her a foam bowl and plastic chopsticks. Fat twists of noodles swam in a thin yellow soup. She ate hungrily, then drank off the soup. She watched as he served a customer, an African woman who took away noodles in her own lidded pot.
Margate,
the noodle man said when the woman was gone. He took a greasy, paper-bound book from beneath the counter and thumbed through it.
Here,
he said, jabbing at an impossibly dense little map.
Down Acre Lane.
He took a blue felt pen and sketched the route on a coarse gray napkin.
Thank you, she said. Now I will go.
Her mother came to her as she made her way to Margate Road. Sally was in jeopardy, somewhere in the sprawl, and Kumiko trusted that Tick would know a way to contact her. If not by phone, then through the Matrix. Perhaps Tick knew Finn, the dead man in the alley. In Brixton, the coral growth of the metropolis had come to harbor a different life. Faces dark and light, uncounted races. The brick facades washed with a riot of shades and symbols unimaginable to the original builders. A drumbeat pulsed from a pub's open door as she passed. Heat and huge laughter. The shop sold foodstuffs Kumiko had never seen. Bolts of bright cloth. Chinese hand tools. Japanese cosmetics. Pausing by that bright window, the display of tints and blushes, her own face reflected in the silver backing, she felt her mother's death fall on her out of the night. Her mother had owned things like this. Her mother's madness. Her father would not refer to it. Madness had no place in her father's world, though suicide did. Her mother's madness was European, an imported snare of sorrow and delusion. Her father had killed her mother, Kumiko had told Sally in Covent Garden. But was it true? He had brought doctors from Denmark, from Australia, and finally from Chiba. The doctors had listened to the dreams of the Princess Ballerina, had mapped and timed her synapses and drawn samples of her blood. The Princess Ballerina had refused their drugs, their delicate surgeries.
"They want to cut my brain with lasers,"
she had whispered to Kumiko. She'd whispered other things as well. At night, she said, the evil ghosts rose like smoke from their boxes in Kumiko's father's study.
"Old men," she'd said. "They suck our breath away. Your father sucks my breath away. This city sucks my breath away. Nothing here is ever still. There is no true sleep."
In the end, there had been no sleep at all. 6 nights, her mother sat, silent and utterly still in her blue European room. On the 7th day, she left the apartment alone, a remarkable feat, considering the diligence of the secretaries, and made her way to the cold river. But the backing of the display was like Sally's glasses. Kumiko took the Korean's map from the sleeve of her sweater. There was a burnt car beside the curb in Margate Road. Its wheels were missing. She paused beside it and was scanning the unrevealing faces of the houses opposite when she heard a sound behind her. Turning to find a twisted gargoyle face under a greasy spill of curls in the light from the half-open door of the nearest house.
"Tick!"
"Terence," he said.
"Actually,"
as the facial convulsion subsided. Tick's flat was on the top floor. The lower floors were empty, unoccupied, peeling wallpaper showing ghostly traces of vanished pictures. The man's limp was more obvious as he climbed the stairs ahead of her. He wore a gray sharkskin suit and thick-soled suede Oxfords the color of tobacco.
"Been expecting you,"
he said, hauling himself up another step. Another.
"You have?"
"No, you'd run from swines. Been logging their traffic when I've had time from the other."
"The other?
You don't know, do you?"
"Excuse me?"
"It's the Matrix. Something's happening. Easier to show you than try to explain it. As though I could explain it, which I can't. I'd say a good 3/4 of humanity is jacked at the moment watching the show."
"I don't understand."
"Doubt anyone does. There's a new macro form in the sector that represents the sprawl."
"A macro form?"
"Very large data construct."
"I came here to warn Sally. Swain and Robin Lanier intend to give her to the ones who plot to kidnap Angela Mitchell."
"Wouldn't worry about that,"
he said, reaching the head of the stairs.
"Sally's already scooped Mitchell and half-killed Swain's man in the sprawl. They're after her in any case now. Bloody everybody'll be after her. Soon. Still, we can tell her when she checks in. if she checks in.
Tick lived in a single large room whose peculiar shape suggested the removal of walls. Large as it was also very crowded. It looked to Kumiko as though someone had deployed the contents of an Akihabara module shop in a space already filled Gaijin style with too many pieces of bulky furniture. In spite of this, it was startlingly neat and tidy. The corners of magazines were aligned with the corners of the low glass table they rested on, beside an unused black ceramic ashtray and a plain white vase of cut flowers. She tried calling again, while Tick filled an electric kettle with water from a filter jug.
"What's that?"
he asked, putting down the jug.
"A mass Neotech guide unit. It's broken now. I can't make Colin come."
"Colin? It's a steam rig?"
"Yes."
"Let's have a look."
He held out his hand.
"My father gave it to me."
Tick whistled.
"Thing cost a fortune. One of their little AIs? How's it work?"
"You close your hand around it, and Colin's there, but no one else can see or hear him."
Tick held the unit beside his ear and shook it.
"It's broken."
"Ow."
"I dropped it."
"It's just the housing that's broken, see? The biosoft's come away from the case, so you can't access it manually."
"Can you repair it?"
"No, but we can access it through a deck if you want."
He returned it. The kettle was boiling. Over tea, she told him the story of her trip to the sprawl and Sally's visit to the shrine in the alley.
"He called her Molly," she said.
Tick nodded, winked several times in rapid succession.
"What she went by over there? What did they talk about?"
"A place called Straylight. A man called Case. An enemy. A woman.
Tessier Ashpool. Found that for her when I rustled Swain's data flow for her. Swain's shopping Molly to this lady, Three Jane, so-called. She has the juiciest file of inside dirt you could imagine. On anything and anyone at all. I've been bloody careful not to look too closely at any of that. Swain's trading it right and left, making a dozen fortunes in the process. I'm sure she's got enough dirt on our Mr. Swain as well."
"And she is here in London?"
"In orbit somewhere, looks like, though some people say she's dead. I was working on that, actually, when the big fella popped into the Matrix."
"Excuse me?"
"Here, I'll show you."
When he returned to the white breakfast table, he carried a shallow square black tray with a number of tiny controls arranged along one side. He placed it on the table and touched one of the minute switches. A cubicle hollow display blinked on above the projector. The neon grid lines of cyberspace, ranged with the bright shapes, both simple and complex, that represented vast accumulations of stored data.
"That's all your standard big shits. Corporations. Very much a fixed landscape, you might say. Sometimes one of them will grow an annex, or you'll see a takeover and two of them merge. But you aren't likely to see a new one, not on that scale. They start small and grow, merge with other small formations."
He reached out to touch another switch.
"About 4 hours ago."
And a plain white vertical column appeared in the exact center of the display.
"This popped up. Or in."
The colored cubes, spheres, and pyramids had rearranged themselves instantly to allow for the round white upright. It dwarfed them entirely, its upper end cut off smoothly by the vertical limit of the display.
"Bastard's bigger than anything,"
Tick said, with a certain satisfaction.
And nobody knows what it is or who it belongs to. But someone must know, Kumiko said.
Stands to reason, yes. But people in my line of work, and there's millions of us, haven't been able to find out. That's stranger in some ways than the fact that the thing's there at all. I was all up and down the grid before you came, looking for any jockey with a clue. Nothing. Nothing at all.
How could this 3Jane be dead?
But then, she remembered the fin. The boxes in her father's study.
I must tell Sally.
Nothing for that but waiting, he said. She'll probably phone in. In the meantime, we could have a go accessing that pricey little AI of yours if you like.
Yes, she said. Thank you.
Only hope those special branch types in Swain's Pay don't track you here. Still, we can only wait.
Yes,
Kumiko said, not at all pleased with the idea of waiting. Chapter 35 The Factory War. Cherry found him with the judge again, down there in the dark. He was sitting on one of the investigators with a flashlight in his hand, shining it up the judge's carapace of polished rust. He didn't remember coming here, but he couldn't feel the jerky edge of Korsakov's. He remembered the girl's eyes in that room Bobby said was London.
Gentry's got the count in his box jacked into a cyberspace deck, Cherry said. You know that?
Slick nodded, still looking up at the judge.
Bobby said we better.
So what's going on? What happened when you both jacked?
Gentry and Bobby, they kind of hit it off. Both crazy the same way. When we jacked, we came out somewhere in orbit, but Bobby wasn't there. Then Mexico, I think.
Who's Tally Isham? Stim Queen when I was little, like Angie Mitchell is now.
Mitchell? She was his squeeze.
Who?
Bobby. He was telling Gentry about it in London.
London?
Yeah. We went there after Mexico.
And he said he was Angie Mitchell's old man? Sounds crazy.
Yeah, but he said that's how he got onto it, that Aleph thing.
He swung the light down and directed it into the skeletal steel maw of the corpse grinder.
He was hanging out with rich people and heard about it. Called it a soul catcher. The people who had it would rent time on it to these rich people. Bobby tried it once, then he went back and stole it. Took it down to Mexico City and started spending all his time in there. But they came after him.
Sounds like you're remembering things anyway.
So he got out of there, went up to Cleveland and made a deal with Africa, gave Africa money to hide him, take care of him while he was under the wire because he was getting real close.
Close to what?
Don't know. Something weird. Like when Gentry talks about the shape.
Well, she said, I think it might kill him being jacked that way. His signs are starting to screw up. He's been on those drips too long. Why I came to find you.
The corpse grinder's steel-fanged guts glinted in the flashlight's beam.
It's what he wants. Anyway, he paid the kid. It's like you're working for him. But those guys Bird saw today, they're working for the people from L.A., the ones Bobby stole the thing from.
Tell me something.
What?
What are these things you build? Africa said you were this crazy white guy built robots out of junk. Said in the summer you take them out there on the rust and stage big fights.
They aren't robots,
he interrupted, swinging the flash to the low, scythe-tipped arms of the spider-legged witch.
They're mainly radio-controlled.
You just build them to wreck them?
No, but I have to test them, see if I got them right.
He clicked off the light.
Crazy white guy,
she said. You got a girl out here?
No.
Get a shower, maybe shave.
Suddenly she was very close to him, her breath on his face.
Okay, people, listen up.
What the fuck?
'Cause I'm not gonna say this twice.
Slick had his hand over Cherry's mouth now.
We want your guest and all his gear. That's all. Repeat. All the gear.
The amplified voice clanged through factory's iron hollow.
Now you can give him to us. That's easy. Or we can just kill all your asses. And we're real easy with that, too. 5 minutes to think about it.
Cherry bit his hand.
Shit, I gotta breathe, okay?
Then he was running through factory's dark, and he heard her call his name. A single 100-watt bulb burned above factory's south gate. A pair of twisted steel doors frozen open with rust. Bird must have left it on. From where he crouched by an empty window, Slick could just make out the hover, out beyond the weak fringe of light. The man with the bullhorn came strolling out of the dark with a calculated looseness meant to indicate that he was on top of things. He wore insulated camo overalls with a thin nylon hood drawn up tight around his head, goggles. He raised the bullhorn.
3 minutes.
He reminded Slick of the guards at the holding pen. The second time he'd been done for stealing cars. Gentry would be watching from upstairs, where a narrow, vertical panel of plexiglass was glued into the wall, high up over factory's gates. Something rattled in the dark off to Slick's right. He turned in time to see Bird in the faint glow from another window gap, maybe 8 meters along the wall, and the glint on the bare alloy silencer as the boy brought up the .22 rifle.
Bird, don't!
A ruby firefly on Bird's cheek. Telltale of a laser sight from out in the solitude. Bird was thrown back into factory as the sound of the shot broke through the empty windows and echoed off the walls. Then, the only sound was the silencer, rolling across concrete.
Fuck it, the big voice boomed cheerfully. You had your chance!
Slick glanced over the rim of the window and saw the men sprinting back to the hover. How many of them would be out there? Bird hadn't said. 2 hovers, the Honda. 10? More? Unless Gentry had a pistol hidden somewhere, Bird's rifle had been their only gun. The hover's turbines kicked in. He guessed they'd just drive right in. They had laser sights, probably infrared, too. Then he heard one of the investigators. The sound it made with its stainless steel treads on the concrete floor. It came crawling out of the dark with its thermite-tipped scorpion sting cocked back low. The chassis had started out 15 years earlier as a remote manipulator intended to handle toxic spills or nuke plant cleanups. Slick had found 3 unassembled units in Newark and traded a Volkswagen for them. Gentry. He'd left his control unit up in the loft. The investigator ground its way across the floor and came to a halt in the wide doorway, facing the solitude and the advancing hover. It was roughly the size of a large motorcycle. Its open frame chassis, a dense bundle of servos, compression tanks, exposed screw gears, hydraulic cylinders. A pair of vicious-looking claws extended from either side of its modest instrument package. Slick wasn't sure what the claws were made from. Maybe some kind of big farm machine. The Hover was a heavy industrial model. Sheets of thick gray plastic armor had been fastened over windshield and windows. Narrow view slits centered in each sheet. The investigator moved, steel tread spraying ice and loose concrete as it drove straight for the Hover, its claws at their widest extension. The Hover's driver reversed, fighting momentum. The investigator's claws snapped furiously at the bulge of the forward apron bag, slid off, snapped again. The bag was reinforced with polycarbon mesh. Then Gentry remembered the thermite lance. It ignited in a tight ball of raw white light and whipped up over the useless claws, plunging through the apron bag like a knife through cardboard. The investigator's tread spun as Gentry drove it against the deflating bag, the lance at full extension. Slick was suddenly aware that he'd been shouting, but didn't know what he'd said. He was on his feet now, as the claws finally found a purchase on the torn edge of the apron bag. He went to the floor again as a hooded, goggled figure popped from a hatch in the Hover's roof like an armed hand puppet, emptying a magazine of 12-gauge slugs that struck sparks off the investigator, which continued to chew its way through the apron bag, outlined against the white pulse of the lance. The investigator froze, claws locked tight on the frayed bag. The shotgunner ducked back into his hatch. Feed line, servo pack, what had the guy hit? The white pulse was dying now, almost dead. The Hover began to reverse, slowly, back across the rust, dragging the investigator with it. It was well back, out of the light, visible only because it was moving, when Gentry discovered the combination of switches that activated the flamethrower, its nozzle mounted beneath the juncture of the claws. Slick watched, fascinated, as the investigator ignited 10 liters of detergent-laced gasoline, a sustained, high-pressure spray. He'd gotten that nozzle, he remembered, off a pesticide tractor. It worked okay. Chapter 36 Soul Catcher. The Hover was headed south when Mama Brigitte came again. The woman with the sealed silver eyes abandoned the gray sedan in another car park, and the street girl with Angie's face told a confusing story. Cleveland, Florida, someone who'd been her boyfriend or pimp or both. But Angie had heard Brigitte's voice in the cabin of the helicopter on the roof of the new Suzuki Envoy.
Trust her, child. In this she does the will of the Lord. A captive in her seat, the buckle of her seatbelt embedded in a solid block of plastic. Angie had watched as the woman bypassed the helicopter's computer and activated an emergency system that allowed for manual piloting. And now this freeway and the winter rain, the girl talking again, above the swish of wipers. Into candle glow, walls of whitewashed limestone, pale moths fluttering in the trailing branches of the willows. Your time draws near. And they are there. The horsemen. The Loa. Papalegba, bright and fluid as mercury. Ezilifreda, who is mother and queen. Zamedi, the barren cimetière, moss on corroded bone. Similor. Madame Travaux. Many others. They fill the hollow that is Grande Brigitte. The rushing of their voices is the sound of wind, running water, the hive. They writhe above the ground like heat above a summer highway, and it has never been like this for Angie, never this gravity, this sense of falling, this degree of surrender. To a place where Legba speaks, his voice the sound of an iron drum. He tells a story. In the hard wind of